being
has
judged.
Gone through too much. Yeah, and we're judged. By the way, the propaganda also tries its best. Like, there are many factors and elements and powers out there that are working against this perfect picture of Islam.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about that. But let's go for a break and then come back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
We're talking about this idea of generalization. Like, when people talk about Islam, they consider all the Muslims from all around the world with different backgrounds, different cultures, different societies, and even ideologies to be the same, to be perfect as Islam is, or as the Islamic scholars have been. But the thing is, the truth is that in the real world, practicing all the detailed rules that Islam has taught us might be a little bit difficult. Not a bit, I would say. In some cases, very much difficult. And it takes a lot of try. And it takes a lot of effort. A lot of, you know, you must go through a drudgery sometimes to be the same. And even Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam themselves have said that to be the same as us is very difficult. But what you're doing is just to try to be a reflection of what we had taught you.
Yeah, and they look at us as if like we are living in some bubbles in dreamland. We have no like problems, no temptations. Nothing is bothering us.
Yeah.
So we are not in the modern world with the same problems of the rest of the people.
Exactly.
So we're just like abiding by Islamic rules, and we need to just be like the role models.
Yeah. Well, the truth is that we must try to be. But
yeah,
as you just said,
we are trying, but we are living on this planet as well.
Like, unfortunately, life happens. Life happens, and things change, and then all the expectations, all that perfect picture might go through some deterioration. So if we put this aside, we come back to this idea of propaganda that I was just saying. Now, all the world, at least right now, I could say that, and I guess it's safe to say that all the world knows that Islam is the religion of kindness and is the religion of the perfect religion that is there to bring unity to the entire world.
Yeah.
They know that, and since they know that, and since they have seen these small communities of Muslim people being so united together, they try to create a different picture that is not really representative of Islam and then impose it on people's mentality and call that as Islam.
It's like a threatening tool towards Islam. Like, they use this as the device, the way, the like aid for them.
Yeah.
So that they can just threaten the community and just blame Muslims for being Muslims.
Exactly.
And specifically considering the situation and the life that we are having, that we are facing with too many difficulties and hardships with modernity, this, I mean, is doubled up.
Exactly.
I mean, and it's really hard. And even the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam have told us, we have had it in our traditions and our narrations, that being a Muslim, being a true believer, in the years close to the arrival of Mahdi ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, is exactly like holding a ball of fire in your hand. Which shows that how tough being a true companion of the Ahlul Bayt can be in these times.
Yeah. So what about the propaganda? Like, you know, nowadays there are many people attributing different stuff on the Muslim community. Like, they try to show that, okay, you have to be away from these people because they, for example, adhere to this sort of thought. They try to slander the Muslim thought and ideology. Muslim, they try to actually look, they try to show this deflected picture of Islam to different cultures and different societies in the world in order for people not to know more about them.
Yeah. And I think in the very first place, we have to differentiate between two classes of people. There are some people who are stuck in this action of generalizing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they have seen some experiences, some examples, and they were so far-fetched from that exemplar of Islam they had in their minds. So yes, they are generalizing it, and they are maybe stuck. But there are some other ones. There are some, maybe I could say, stakeholders in this fact, that those are playing the deceitful rules. Those are the ones that are actually adding fire to this propaganda that is spreading.
Yeah.
And those are the ones that have seen how powerful Islam and the proponents of Islam can be. And this is the very nature of Islam that they're afraid of.
Yeah. And then, by the way, just as we were talking about generalization, there are two categories of Muslims. And let's say people, because the second category that I'm going to talk, who are the actually the tools of that propaganda that we were just talking about, they're not considered to be Muslim, but they take them as Muslim in order to create this unrealistic picture of Islamic people, of the Muslim people. The first one was just the society that we were depicting, like the kind of societies that try to be Islamic, but still there might be some flaws.
Yeah, we're
they're
not
going to, but the other category that we were just talking about, like what we saw, like ISIS was not Islam.
Yeah.
It could never be considered as even a part of Islam, because as we already know, Islam is never with hostility. Our prophet was the kindest of all the prophets. So he was the prophet of kindness. How could he be adhering to such ideas?
Yeah, and this calls for the attention, like towards Islam, this attention that whoever claims to be like Muslim or Islamic is not going to be the sample to be judged and to be labeled, and then like later on label the feature to the whole community of Muslims.
If you want to wrap it all up in one or two sentences, what would you say?
Well, I would say that the act of generalizing is deep inside us of all. But what we really need to consider is the fact that we need to be worrying about whether we are consciously doing it or not. So the fact that we, even we, see the proponents of the others and do not generalize them as because they are just representatives of that religion, this also, this rule applies to us as well. We do have to consider ourselves not an exception.
Yeah, thank you very much. And thank you, sister.
Well.
And
pleasure.
Thank you, dear listeners. This was all the time for today's episode. I hope you have just enjoyed that. Until another session, I wish you health and happiness. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, Letti Ummara. يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي التي أما رايزك لتصي دليلتك وانسك
يوسف جلالي بتهران
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Anger on the streets against the U.S. and Israel in Pakistan. Tens of thousands took to the streets across Pakistan to mourn the martyrdom of Hezbollah's leaders, Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah and Sayyid Hashim Safiuddin. Chanting anti-U.S. and anti-Israel slogans, the mourners converged on the Skardu region of Gilgit-Baltistan in northern Pakistan to pay tribute to the martyrs of resistance.
Shaheed Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah,
The martyrs of resistance, including iconic figures like Hassan Nasrallah, have left an indelible influence on the region. Their sacrifices have not only strengthened the spirit of resistance against occupation and injustice, but have also united movements across borders. They represent a legacy of resilience that continues to inspire new generations in the fight for dignity and sovereignty.
The attendees in the gatherings lauded Nasrallah's unwavering stance against the foreign interference and his leadership in unifying various factions in the region.
Imam Khomeini's discourse transcended Iran's borders. His message of the oppressed versus oppressors became a global call for resistance against imperialism and occupation. And now, martyrs of resistance, whether in Gaza, Lebanon, or Iraq, have followed Imam Khomeini's legacy, which is fighting for dignity, freedom, and justice.
Participants condemned Israel's continued aggression against innocent Palestinians and urged the global community to take immediate action to halt the violence, ensure the delivery of humanitarian aid, and hold Israel accountable for its violations of international law.
Through prayers, speeches, and peaceful rallies, Pakistanis expressed their reverence for the martyred leaders while reaffirming their support for resistance movements against injustice and oppression. Nasik Azmi, Islamabad.
A fresh series of large-scale military exercises. This is Zulfaqar. And with every branch of the Iranian army participating, it sends a clear message, one that showcases the country's most recent advancements in its defensive capabilities.
With the Zulfaqar military exercises already in full swing, its second day has brought together all four branches of Iran's armed forces, with the operations blending advanced equipment, coordinated tactics, and specialized training to strengthen both defensive and offensive capabilities. The speed and efficiency of the forces showcase the readiness of the country's military forces.
These operations are highly complex, involving a range of hardware and specialized training, all coming together to perform tasks with a defensive and offensive in nature. Overall, all the military hardware and munitions have worked flawlessly. The speed of execution was particularly impressive.
Coastal defense operations were a key focus, with naval commandos securing strategic positions and preventing enemy activity. Innovative tactics were also applied, using updated weaponry, with successful operations ranging from anti-ship strikes to artillery fire on their designated targets, underlining the growing sophistication of Iran's military.
The core of this operation is safeguarding and defending the coastline, which falls to our naval commandos. Securing key positions and identifying the main entry points to the shore are crucial. That's why the planning for this exercise has evolved at every stage, especially in terms of tactics. We've upgraded our weapons to match the needs, but what really sets these exercises apart are the innovative tactics we've applied in the deployment of equipment, weaponry, and personnel.
In support of naval operations, ground and air forces demonstrated their capabilities to respond swiftly and effectively. From rapid beach defense operations to the interception of enemy drones, these joint exercises highlighted the synergy between different military units. The use of advanced unmanned aerial systems has also added a new layer to Iran's defense capabilities. As these exercises continue, they underscore the ongoing evolution of the country's defense strategies in the face of modern threats. Ali Ramazani, Kalat.
On a Saturday in the heart of New York City, people of all walks of life gathered at the People's Fair for Gaza, organized by the Shut It Down for Palestine Coalition, to donate to the people and children of Gaza and the rebuilding of the city. Vendors were selling handmade crafts of Palestinian heritage and artwork alongside food like kunafa and olive oil.
We are here just to celebrate Palestinian life and culture by the exchange of goods and services that represent the diaspora that has been oppressed by institutions and governments on an international scale.
Israel has violated the ceasefire on numerous occasions. They are continuing raids into the West Bank. Benjamin Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant are still war criminals at large. And so until the occupation ends, until Palestine is free, communities, individuals, and organizations of every level should continue to boycott, divest, sanction the Israeli apartheid genocide state.
We spoke with a few participants who expressed the necessity of continuing to support Palestine in every way possible, and how the notion of resistance goes beyond protests as well.
We're here today to bring awareness to what's happening in Gaza. I think it's important for communities to align together, to raise funds for those who are unfortunate there, who are being displaced, help families out in need of food, water, aid. You know, we're a local honey company, and we like to help out in any community that we can, but this time we're focusing on Gaza because I feel like it's a very important topic. It's very prevalent today.
Why are we still here and continuing to fight for Gaza? I think one thing that's really important, and you can see it in our tote bag, that resistance is love. And that goes beyond the idea of what resistance means to many Americans, which is protesting, which is needed direct action on the ground. But beyond that, what's lost in translation is the need to actually stand with Gazans on the ground, engage in mutual aid, and actually support the initiatives that they're doing to rebuild their own country. And the country that we funded to get bombed and destroyed. If you could go here and also be able to spend your money responsibly and donate back, but not even donate, like actually have a tangible impact where this money is going directly back into Gaza.
Despite tightening grips, New York has long been an active scene in calling for an end to arming Israel amid the genocide in Gaza and an end to the occupation of Palestine, and in forms of support continuously seeming endless.
Even after the ceasefire, community efforts for Gaza continue in ways such as donations, art, and collective support to ensure that the Palestinian cause remains alive. Rachel Hamdouin, New York.
The BDS movement in Spain, along with the Solidarity Network Against the Occupation of Palestine, has called for a large demonstration in Madrid under the slogan, Stop the Genocide in Palestine, Palestine is not for sale. The protest condemns Israel's impunity in committing genocide, ethnic cleansing, and territorial expansion, while criticizing the West's hypocritical silence and inaction which enabled these crimes.
The Palestinian people suffer relentless injustice as Israel violates agreements with impunity. Ceasefires offer no real guarantees. We demand the Spanish government take a firm stance, pushing for sanctions and isolation if Israel continues defying international law. Inaction enables the occupation and atrocities.
The demonstration began in front of the U.S. Embassy, a symbolic center of imperialist support for Israel's settler colonial project. Protesters staged a loud pot-banging protest, voicing their opposition to Washington's unwavering military, financial, and political backing of the Zionist regime.
Supporting these mobilizations is a moral imperative. Standing with Palestinians after decades of oppression is urgent. Meanwhile, our authorities secretly sustain the arms trade with a regime accused of genocide, making them complicit in these crimes. Silence is not neutrality, it's complicity.
The Palestinian cause is a fight for humanity. Those who don't defend it are misled by distorted media. For nearly 80 years, Israel has falsely claimed victimhood while committing some of the worst crimes since the World War II.
The march moved to the European Commission in Madrid, where activists condemned the EU's hypocrisy, claiming to defend human rights while funding and arming Israel's occupation. The mobilization denounces Israel's ethnic cleansing in Gaza and demands an end to arms trade, military cooperation, and ties with the Zionist entity. With the call to stop the genocide in Palestine and arms trade and ties with Israel, people in Madrid once again take to the streets to demand an immediate halt to military and diplomatic cooperation with Israel, exposing the complicity of Western powers in the ongoing ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people. Alberto Garcia, Madrid.
A candlelit vigil in honor of the martyred Hezbollah leader right outside Tehran's Grand Mosalla. Inside, the atmosphere charged with emotion. A massive crowd present to pay tribute to Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah in a ceremony held simultaneously with his funeral in Beirut, uniting supporters from all walks of life, reaffirming their commitment to his ideals.
Martyr Nasrallah is a symbol of resistance who fought for the freedom of Palestine and Lebanon. We will continue his path.
We are here to affirm that the path of the martyrs continues, and we will carry on their legacy.
In the path of resistance, the blood of every martyr inspires the rest of us to forge a new generation committed to victory for the cause.
The ceremony features speeches, prayers, and moments of reflection, highlighting martyr Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's influential role in shaping the resistance movement.
Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah is the most outstanding personality in the Arab world. Even his enemies praise and admire him. Zionist officials, reliable Western experts, theoreticians consider him as an amazing personality who was never afraid of death. They believe him to be an influential speaker. Whenever he spoke, the echoes of his speech reached U.S. officials in the White House. The equation that he created on the battlefield went beyond the scene in Lebanon. He had attained a determining personality in regional equations with global dimensions. The reason for this was that he acted on what he believed in and had faith in. He kept his promises. He would fulfill any promises he made. Zionist citizens had more belief and faith in the promises of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah than they had in those of their own officials.
The ceremony is accompanied by a strong sense of purpose. The attendees expressing their determination to continue the fight for justice and resistance against oppressive forces, drawing strength from martyr Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's enduring legacy.
With Tehran's Grand Masallah packed with mourners, massive crowds gathered in the Iranian capital, Tehran, to bid farewell to this great martyr and legendary resistance figure. Yusuf Shahmadi, Tehran.
The Nigerian Senate said the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, is accused of sponsoring terrorist groups, including the Nigerian insurgent group Boko Haram. The Nigerian legislative body said this is a weighty allegation which should be thoroughly investigated. The lawmakers said USAID and other non-governmental organizations had given many Nigerians cause to question their motives in the troubled northeast of Nigeria. Leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, has always said that the United States and other Western countries are complicit in the sponsor of Boko Haram terrorists in Nigeria. Boko Haram is an insurgent group that started in 2009 and has killed tens of thousands of Nigerians in frequent brutal attacks. Over 2 million Nigerians have been displaced from their homes, in addition to destruction of hospitals, schools, and basic infrastructure by Boko Haram. The allegation that said that USAID is sponsoring Boko Haram and other terrorists came as a startling revelation to many Nigerians, but experts are not surprised.
When you look at the antecedents of the United States, you see that they have been involved in either financing or stoking ember of discord around the world, only to further their own cause. For example, after they damaged Libya, damaged Iraq, and tried to damage Afghanistan, this was when they began to send in their military-industrial complexes.
Experts argue that if allegations of USAID sponsoring terrorism prove true, it would be a striking irony. The United States has long presented itself as a global leader in counterterrorism, but such a revelation would severely undermine its moral authority on the world stage. Danjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
Arriving to a hero's welcome, Ben Jamal, director of the UK-based Palestine Solidarity Campaign, appears at his pre-trial, charged with public order offenses following a major pro-Palestine rally in London last month, which he was an organizer of. Supporters say he was unfairly charged.
I'd like them to dismiss this as ridiculous charges, the whole thing, and just let him walk free.
We want the court to drop all charges against Ben Jamal, not just Ben Jamal, but every single person who's been unjustly arrested by the police over the last 16 months. There's been so many arrests, and they've been politically motivated.
The demonstration in question took place on January 18th. The Metropolitan Police had approved the organizers' proposed route from the BBC's headquarters to Whitehall. but reversed course ahead of the march, saying it would disturb services at a synagogue.
It's a complete and utter fabrication. There have been no threats to synagogues or to Jewish worshippers. Every single demonstration has had hundreds and hundreds of Jewish protesters. If there was even the slightest threat to Jews or to synagogue worshippers, those same Jewish protesters and thousands of others would do all we could to protect the synagogue, to protect Jews, because fundamentally these Palestine demonstrations are anti-racist, against all racism, including anti-Semitism.
The pressure to clamp down on the Palestine solidarity protest came from pro-Israel groups like the Board of Deputies of British Jews, pro-Israel MPs, and Chief Rabbi Ephraim Mervis, who has supported Israel's use of force against Palestinians. In addition to their outrage over the 77 arrests on January 18th, the protesters here say they're worried about their right to protest.
We saw the Public Order Act brought in by the Conservative government, which brought in loads of powers to continue to suppress and oppress the right to protest and make it more and more difficult for people to protest. And, you know, lots of people called that out at the time, and that was a Conservative policy. But it's something that's been upheld by the Labour government, and I think that's what's really terrifying. And we are lots of people saying that we're taking a step back and moving into incredibly dark times.
In the same month as those arrests, Britain saw Israeli General Oded Bazhak and his delegation visiting the UK with special diplomatic immunity. A member of the Israeli military, Bazhak was involved in Israel's genocidal war on Gaza and its offensive in southern Lebanon.
This is arguably a dangerous moment for British democracy. That fear shared by the protesters here who say they feel they live in a country that grants diplomatic immunity to war criminals who oversaw genocide, and yet it persecutes those who organized peaceful protests aimed solely at stopping that very genocide. Saeed Bourza, London.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. English Radio.
In the limelight. United States, a judge has cleared the Trump administration to place over 2,000 U.S. aid workers on leave. The order by a Trump-appointed judge is considered a significant setback for government employee unions who have filed a lawsuit against the firings. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. British newspaper The Guardian has covered the story. A federal judge on Friday, 21st of February, cleared the way for the Trump administration to put more than 2,000 U.S. Agency for International Development, or U.S. aid workers, on leave. A setback for government employee unions that are suing over what they have called an effort to dismantle the foreign aid agency. U.S. District Judge Carl Nichols in Washington lifted a temporary restraining order he had put in place at the outset of the case and declined to issue a longer-term order keeping the employees in their posts. He wrote that he was satisfied by the Trump administration's assurances in court filings that USAID personnel abroad who were placed on leave would still be protected by U.S. security. U.S. District Judge Carl Nichols, who was appointed by Donald Trump during his first term in office, also wrote that because the affected employees had not gone through an administrative dispute process, he likely did not have jurisdiction to hear the union's case or consider their broader arguments that the Trump administration is violating the U.S. Constitution by shutting down an agency created and funded by the U.S. Congress. Meanwhile, Sky Perriman, president of the legal nonprofit Democracy Forward, which represents the unions, said in a statement, "We are disappointed in today's decision and believe the harms faced by U.S. aid workers are real. We remain confident that the courts of law will find the administration's effort to decimate U.S. aid contrary to the law." The Trump White House did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The lawsuit was brought earlier this month by the American Federation of Government Employees and the American Foreign Service Association. The global anti-poverty group Oxfam has since joined the case, though U.S. District Judge Carl Nichols has not yet considered its claims. Donald Trump ordered a 90-day freeze on all foreign aid on his first day in office, throwing global humanitarian relief efforts into chaos. In the following weeks, officials took steps that have largely shut down U.S. aid operations, including placing much of its staff on leave, suspending or terminating most of its contracts, and shuttering its Washington headquarters. The U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said in a 4th of February letter to Congress that he had taken over as acting director of USAID, which Congress established as an agency independent of the State Department in 1998. Marco Rubio wrote that the State Department would consult with Congress about absorbing parts of USAID and shutting down the rest. The foreign aid freeze and potential USAID shutdown have prompted multiple legal challenges in courts of law. U.S. District Judge Carl Nichols' orders comes just a day after a different judge who is presiding over lawsuits brought against the administration by foreign aid contractors and grant recipients for the second time ordered the administration to resume payments on frozen contracts and grants after it failed to comply with an earlier order. The national broadcaster ABC News has also covered this story. A federal judge on Friday, 21st of February, cleared the way for the Trump administration to pull thousands of U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, staffers off the job in the United States and around the world. U.S. District Judge Carl Nichols declined to keep in place his temporary block on the effort to remove all but a small fraction of USAID staffers from their posts as part of an administration plan that would also give those abroad a 30-day deadline to move back to the United States at government expense. His ruling comes in a lawsuit filed by unions on behalf of workers. Their objections include that the rush to dismantle the agency had cut off some staffers overseas from emergency communication systems and other essential support, including some in danger because of political violence in Congo. Those challenging the Trump administration's rapid breakup of U.S. aid are more broadly challenging the constitutionality of the move, saying eliminating an agency could require congressional approval. Meanwhile, U.S. District Judge Carl Nichols wrote in his ruling, "At present, the agency is still standing, and so the alleged injuries on which plaintiffs rely in seeking injunctive relief flow essentially from their members' existing employment relationships with USAID." Judge Nichols found that the union's challenge must be dealt with under federal employment laws rather than in district court. President Donald Trump and the cost-cutting Department of Government Efficiency tied to billionaire Elon Musk have moved swiftly to shutter U.S. aid, asserting without evidence that its work is wasteful and out of line with President Donald Trump's agenda. Multiple lawsuits from groups representing U.S. aid workers and non-profit organizations and businesses are challenging the job cuts and the sudden shutdown of the agency overall, as well as freezing on foreign assistance. Another court order has temporarily blocked the halt to funding. Judge Nichols said he had been very concerned about workers in high-risk areas left overseas without access to emergency communications, but has since been reassured by the Trump administration that they will still have access to two-way radios that allow communications 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in emergencies, as well as a phone app with a panic button. He said the government statements persuaded him that the risk posed to USAID employees who are placed on administrative leave while stationed abroad, if there is any, is far more minimal than it initially appeared. Pregnant women, meanwhile, fear over their care. The Trump administration has stalled medical evacuations for as many as 25 U.S. aid staffers and spouses in their later stages of high-risk pregnancies overseas, according to testimony in lawsuits and a person familiar with the cases. USAID will, under all measures as appropriate to ensure the safety and security of current employees, Deputy Administrator Pete Morocco said in a court filing on Thursday. The administration says it is taking all required care of staffers as it terminates U.S. aid programs and aims to recall thousands of workers and their families who live abroad. The American women and their spouses, however, say they have been left in substandard medical care in posts in unstable countries, fearing for their lives. Everyone says, I need to wait and see what happens with Trump administration's decision. USAID staffer, whose pregnancy is complicated by high blood pressure, said in a court filing that her posting in an undisclosed country in Africa. The woman's affidavit and others from staffers were filed with courts of law anonymously because of repeated warnings from the Trump administration that USAID staffers risk dismissal if they speak publicly.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamidi.
Islamidi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Youth Station. Well, this is Asma. I'm so happy to be here again in the cozy, sweet corner. And then with me I have...
Brother Ali. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam. Well, how's everything, brother?
Alhamdulillah, everything's good. Like, often we found in our workplace and the place where we study or something, like, people are from different backgrounds.
Yeah.
They're not all from the same religion.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even different countries.
Exactly.
Different backgrounds, different religions. On the daily basis, when people look at you, they get a certain idea that you belong to a certain community, you belong to a certain background, you belong to a certain religion. So they get an idea of that. So, like, they look at you praying. They look at you like, oh, when they get to know that you're fasting.
Yeah.
But they get to know that you're a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
You believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So they get this basic idea.
And it's good if they get that idea. Because nowadays, based
definitely
on the propaganda, what they get from Islam is very complicated.
More, I should say that it's recommended that you should present a good image of Islam.
Yeah.
So the people around you, the youth, the mates, the folks around you, mm-hmm. when they get to know that you're Muslim, so sometimes people inquire you about your religion.
Yeah.
So the non-Muslims might be Christians, Hindus, Jews from any religion. What do you think like could be the best way to introduce Islam to them? Like, what do you think?
I guess my action. My actions would present myself. Like, I do believe that actions are stronger than words or than any other stuff. Like, based on my action, I'm going to be a representative of my religion, of the things that I believe in. In today's world, what human beings care so much about is humanity, which is lost in many, let's say, many places of the world. I don't want to say countries, because still I'm not hopeless and disappointed about humanity. I do believe that in all parts of the world, there is this torch of humanity. There's this essence of humanity that everybody is looking for. Maybe they do not find it. Maybe they try to find it. Maybe they are practicing humanity. It depends on the people. I usually say that, I was just talking about the propaganda. People, based on propagandistic ideas, mm-hmm. would take Islam as represented by ISIS, by politics, by the policymakers, the bad ones, I mean, mm-hmm. not the good ones, not the ones that try to give you the real, realistic image of Islam.
Yeah.
They would have that propagandistic idea, but in order to break this stereotype, in order to clash it down, you have to present your religion based on your actions. For example, if I'm living in a workplace in which other people are Christian or even Jew, I can show them that in my religion, caring for others is a virtue. And being sympathetic is a virtue.
Yeah, exactly. And this subject is kind of sensitive for the people living in the West, or especially any non-Muslim country.
Yeah.
So you being a Muslim, you would be acting as a representative to the religion of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to Islam.
Exactly.
Because, for example, in a workplace, well, where everyone is non-Muslim, for example, one colleague would see the other colleague, his partner, just as his colleague.
Yeah.
But one colleague, when he notices that the other person is a Muslim, he belongs to a different religion, mm-hmm. he would see him as a Muslim colleague.
Exactly.
So that would, you know, that would apply a badge on your personality. Oh, yeah. This person is Muslim. So they would notice you. So, and they would make an image.
And they whatever would set they an image see in from their mind. You.
Yeah. Oh, so Muslims are like,
yeah, these. Exactly. They would generalize it.
Yeah.
So we have to be careful about how we are presenting our religion.
Exactly.
That's why I say actions are very important. Like the way you talk to other people, how sincere you are, and how honest you are, how trustworthy you are, how, I don't know, like all the good or bad traits, whatever you are showing yourself or presenting yourself to a specific community is going to be generalized to your religion.
Exactly. Regarding the actions, there's actually a hadith from Imam Ja'far Sadiq alayhi salam, "Kunu da'at lin-nas bighayri al-sinatikum." So which could be translated to, embrace Islam with your actions.
Exactly.
Not with your words.
Mm-hmm. So I usually say that the first experiences are going to be kept as very important images in your mind. Like they would have this indelible imprint in your mind. For example, I guess we all have had this experience that if you had a Christian friend back in time when you were a child, and that friend happened to be a very kind, respectful person, then for the rest of your life, you would take that Christian friend of yours as the representative of Christianity. Forever, you would think that all the Christian people are so kind, while you know that there are exceptions.
Yeah, that's actually a human tendency. Like, you know, they tend to generalize
exactly.
everything.
Yeah, that would be a and matter of generalization. Not good, yeah. That's a matter of, and since there is this generalization, we have to be careful. Now, as a Muslim person, what are the traits that would be in congruity with my religion that I have to present them whenever I'm interacting with other people? in order to be a good ambassador of my religion. So we go for a break and then we come back to see what they are.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Well, I remember we had a teacher, and then she used to be, like, we were so sensitive about her attitude. Whenever she was sad, it meant that. And since we loved her, we all loved her, because she was such an icon in that school. A character who was so magnetic, though she wasn't so much into speaking and talking. Like, she didn't talk too much, but she was so powerful in the way she attracted all the students, because she was a perfect teacher. And then whenever she was sad, we started to think that, okay, maybe we have done something wrong to make her sad. And then whenever she was happy, it was perfectly clear for us that she's happy for us. Either we have done the best of ourselves in the exams, or stuff's like related to our study. So then, based on her attitudes, based on whatever, she attracted us to herself, and then whatever she did became a model for us. So as just by attracting through actions, she made us interested in the way she dresses and the way she treats other people, and the way, like, we took her as a role model.
Yeah, exactly. A good personality draws people's attention. So
and
if
then
the actions are good.
Add to these good traits the fact that she was a real Muslim teacher. Like, she cared for students who had, you know, background issues, like they had some personal issues in their family. She tried to keep an eye on them. She tried to look after them. She tried to be so sensitive, like a mother, like a real kind mother to them. Like all the Islamic role models that we have, she was a perfect representative of that.
So getting back to your question, what you asked, what could be the traits? Like, for example, like when our discussion is, the main point of our discussion are the actions, right? So, like, how you present yourself is the way you present your religion. The thing is, Islam is a deen. And what is deen? Deen is a way of living life.
It's a lifestyle.
It's a lifestyle according to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The ahkam, the set of rules that Allah has set the boundaries, you're following that. And Islam promotes peace.
Exactly.
And justice, you know, these are the things. Like, if you follow these basic things, you don't have to do something like you have to go extra or something. Just following these basic rules, like being compassionate, being compassionate about justice, and like, you know, caring about others. And, you know, like in these recent times, just the Palestinian issue. So many people have embraced Islam. And what's the reason behind that? The reason behind that, like, if they saw that, you know, Islam is a religion that cares so much about justice.
We are human beings. And I guess we already know that all human beings might go for mistakes. And there might be some flaws and error in their characteristics, in their personality, in their worldview, and whatever related to them personally. But then I usually say that, when you are in a community that does not belong to your own notions or to your own religion, you have to be very careful. Even if there is a bad trait in you, you shouldn't expose it to the entire world.
Yeah.
I usually say that. Even if, for example, there's something like, for, you know, the examples are already very much clear in our life. Like, for example, if I do something wrong, if I don't have a perfect schedule for my sleep, for my sleeping time, and there is this chaotic planning for my life, I don't have to be very proud of it and show it to the entire world. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, like, once you're living with your own nation, in your own, among your own people, the story is different. Like, they already know about the religion, and they know that you are not a representative of your religion, because you're a human being and you might be
going the wrong direction.
Yeah.
But for when you go to another community, to another country, to another nation, and you become a part of them, you have to be very careful about what you do. Even if there is a bad trait in you, then you can change it.
Yeah.
Start step by step.
Right.
Just, you know, I mean that it is your trait, but now as the one who is becoming a representative of your own religion, you have to first hide it and then start to change it little by little. Because you no longer are yourself, just yourself.
Arguments are need to be proposed. You know, someone like they get to know that you're a Muslim, they're interested in your religion, they need to know more about your religion. So now the debates, the discussions, so the basic arguments, like, you know, why there is a creator, where did we come from, who created us. So, like, these basic things, why there's only one Lord, and why does that Lord need to have his prophet to be sent on earth for the guidance, and his wasi, his successor.
Yeah.
So, like, all these things, like, the basic arguments.
Specific questions.
Yeah, these specific questions.
But you must have the knowledge, actually, to answer back.
Yeah, so what you need to do is, like, you need to have a basic idea yourself, first. Well, it's your religion, you need to know it.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, okay, so you're not very good at you know, letting others know, like, and delivering these things, these arguments. Get that person in contact with any scholar, or suggest him any books or something.
Exactly.
So that he can learn more about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One thing about Islam is this religion is completely rational. It's completely
logical.
Logical. It's, you know, it's completely it's completely in synchronization with the intellects of the people.
Yeah.
So
it's not superstition based on mythology.
Yeah. So being logical means that, you know, any person, any rational person would accept the reality.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing about Islam. You know, it's a universal thing.
The common language between all human beings is the language of kindness and caring and humanity, which I guess is very much common in Islam. And it's the, as I just said, it's the foundation. It's the basic foundation of Islam, which has been practiced by the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam. And I guess this is one of the most important thing that could be delivered to the entire world based on our action, that Muslim people are kind to each other, to their sisters and brothers. And this is very lovely, interesting, and beautiful about Islam. So this was all about today's episode. I hope you have just enjoyed it. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you dear youth will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about this.
We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Hamas parliament speaker says presence of massive crowds at the funeral of Hezbollah's martyred leaders is a testament to the resistance movement's unbreakable popular support. Another